The Professor by Charlotte Bronte. Chapter 15. Some time elapsed before I again gave a lesson in the first class. The holiday of Whitsuntide occupied 3 days, and on the fourth it was the turn of the second division to receive my instructions. As I made the transit of the Carré, I observed, as usual, the band of sewers surrounding Mademoiselle Henri. There were only about a dozen of them, but they made as much noise as might have sufficed for 50. They seemed very little under her control. 3 or 4 at once assailed her with importunate requirements. She looked harassed. She demanded silence, but in vain. She saw me, and I read in her eye pain that a stranger should witness the insubordination of her pupils. She seemed to entreat order. Her prayers were useless. Then I remarked that she compressed her lips and contracted her brow, and her countenance, if I read it correctly, said, "I have done my best. I seem to merit blame notwithstanding. Blame me then who will." I passed on. As I closed the schoolroom door, I heard her say suddenly and sharply, addressing one of the eldest and most turbulent of the lot, "Amélie Mullenberg, ask me no question and request of me no assistance for a week to come. During that space of time I will neither speak to you nor help you." The words were uttered with emphasis, nay, with vehemence, and a comparative silence followed. Whether the calm was permanent, I know not. 2 doors now closed between me and the carré. Next day was appropriated to the first class. On my arrival I found the directress seated as usual in a chair between the 2 estrades, and before her was standing Mademoiselle Henri, in an attitude, as it seemed to me, of somewhat reluctant attention. The directress was knitting and talking at the same time. Amidst the hum of a large schoolroom, it was easy so to speak in the ear of one person as to be heard by that person alone, and it was thus Mademoiselle Routier parleyed with her teacher. The face of the latter was a little flushed, not a little troubled. There was vexation in it, whence resulting I know not, for the directress looked very placid indeed. She could not be scolding in such gentle whispers and with so equitable a mien. No, it was presently proved that her discourse had been of the most friendly tendency, for I heard the closing words. "C'est assez, mon bon ami. À présent, je n'ai vu pas vous retenir davantage." Without reply, Mademoiselle Henri turned away. Dissatisfaction was plainly evinced in her face, and a smile, slight and brief, but bitter, distrustful, and I thought scornful, curled her lip as she took her place in the class. It was a secret, involuntary smile, which lasted but a second. An air of depression succeeded, chased away presently by one of attention and interest when I gave the word for all the pupils to take their reading books. In general, I hated the reading lesson. It was such a torture to the ear to listen to their uncouth mouthing of my native tongue, and no effort of example or precept on my part ever seemed to effect the slightest improvement in their accent. Today, each in her appropriate key lisped, stuttered, mumbled, and jabbered as usual. About 15 had racked me in turn, and my auricular nerve was expecting with resignation the discords of the 16th, when a full, though low voice, read out in clear and correct English, "On his way to Perth, the king was met by a Highland woman calling herself a prophetess. She stood at the side of the ferry by which he was about to travel to the north, and cried with a loud voice, 'My lord, the king, if you pass this water, you will never return again alive.'" From Vide, The History of Scotland. I looked up in amazement. The voice was a voice of Albion. The accent was pure and silvery. It only wanted firmness and assurance to be the counterpart of what any well-educated lady in Essex or Middlesex might have announced. Yet the speaker or reader was no other than Mademoiselle Henri, in whose grave, joyless face I saw no mark of consciousness that she had performed any extraordinary feat. No one else evinced surprise either. Mademoiselle Routier knitted away assiduously. I was aware, however, that at the conclusion of the paragraph she had lifted her eyelid and honored me with a glance sideways. She did not know the full excellency of the teacher's style of reading, but she perceived that her accent was not that of the others and wanted to discover what I thought. I masked my visage with indifference and ordered the next girl to proceed. When the lesson was over, I took advantage of the confusion caused by breaking up to approach Mademoiselle Henri. She was standing near the window and retired as I advanced. She thought I wanted to look out and did not imagine that I could have anything to say to her. I took her exercise book out of her hand. As I turned over the leaves, I addressed her. "You have had lessons in English before?" I asked.
"No, sir."
"No? You read it well. You have been in England?"
"Oh, no," with some animation.
"You have been in English families?" Still the answer was no. Here, my eye rested on the flyleaf of the book, saw written, "Francis Evan Henri."
"Your name?" I asked.
"Yes, sir." My interrogations were cut short. I heard a little rustling behind me, and close at my back was the directress, professing to be examining the interior of a desk. "Mademoiselle," said she, looking up and addressing the teacher, "will you have the goodness to go and stand in the corridor while the young ladies are putting on their things and try to keep some order?" Mademoiselle Henri obeyed. "What splendid weather," observed the directress cheerfully, glancing at the same time from the window. I assented and was withdrawing. "What of your new pupil, monsieur?" continued she, following my retreating steps. "Is she likely to make progress in English?" "Indeed, I can hardly judge. She possesses a pretty good accent. Of her real knowledge of the language, I have as yet had no opportunity of forming an opinion." "And her natural capacity, monsieur?" "I have had my fears about that. Can you relieve me by an assurance at least of its average power?"
"I see no reason to doubt its average power, mademoiselle, but really, I scarcely know her, and have not had time to study the caliber of her capacity."
"I wish you a very good afternoon." She still pursued me. "You'll observe, monsieur, and tell me what you think. I could so much better rely on your opinion than on my own. Women cannot judge of these things as men can, and excuse my pertinacity, monsieur, but it is natural I should feel interested about this poor little girl, pauvre petite. She has scarcely any relations. Her own efforts are all she has to look to. Her acquirements must be her sole fortune. Her present position has once been mine, or nearly so. It is then but natural I should sympathize with her, and sometimes, when I see the difficulty she has in managing pupils, I feel quite chagrined. I doubt not she does her best. Her intentions are excellent, but, monsieur, she wants tact and firmness. I have talked to her on the subject, but I am not fluent, and probably did not express myself with clearness. She never appears to comprehend me. Now, would you occasionally, when you see an opportunity, slip in a word of advice to her on the subject? Men have so much more influence than women have. They argue so much more logically than we do, and you, monsieur, in particular, have so paramount a power of making yourself obeyed. A word of advice from you could not but do her good, even if she were sullen and headstrong, which I hope she is not. She would scarcely refuse to listen to you. For my own part, I can truly say that I never attend one of your lessons without deriving benefit from witnessing your management of the pupils. The other masters are a constant source of anxiety to me. They cannot impress the young ladies with sentiments of respect, nor restrain the levity natural to youth. And you, monsieur, I feel the most absolute confidence. Try, then, to put this poor child into the way of controlling our giddy, high-spirited brabantoises. But, monsieur, I would add one word more. Don't alarm her, amour propre. Beware of inflicting a wound there. I reluctantly admit that in that particular she is blamably, some would say ridiculously, susceptible. I fear I have touched this sore point inadvertently, and she cannot get over it. During the greater part of this harangue, my hand was on the lock of the outer door. I now turned it. "Au revoir, mademoiselle," said I, and I escaped. I saw the directress's stock of words was yet far from exhausted. She looked after me. She would fain have detained me longer. Her manner towards me had been altered ever since I had begun to treat her with hardness and indifference. She almost cringed to me on every occasion. She consulted my countenance incessantly and beset me with innumerable little officious attentions. Servility creates despotism. This slavish homage, instead of softening my heart, only pampered whatever was stern and exacting in its mood. The very circumstance of her hovering round me like a fascinated bird seemed to transform me into a rigid pillar of stone. Her flatteries irritated my scorn, her blandishments confirmed my reserve. At times I wondered what she meant by giving herself such trouble to win me. When the more profitable Pelet was already in her nets, and when, too, she was aware that I possessed her secret, for I had not scrupled to tell her as much. But the fact is that, as it was her nature to doubt the reality and undervalue the worth of modesty, affection, disinterestedness, to regard these qualities as foibles of character,
So it was equally her tendency to consider pride, hardness, selfishness as proofs of strength. She would trample on the neck of humility. She would kneel at the feet of disdain. She would meet tenderness with secret contempt. Indifference she would woo with ceaseless assiduities. Benevolence, devotedness, enthusiasm were her antipathies. For dissimulation and self-interest she had a preference. They were real wisdom in her eyes. Moral and physical degradation, mental and bodily inferiority, she regarded with indulgence. They were foils capable of being turned to good account as set-offs for her own endowments. To violence, injustice, tyranny, she succumbed. They were her natural masters. She had no propensity to hate, no impulse to resist them. The indignation their behests awake in some hearts was unknown in hers. From all this, it resulted that the false and selfish called her wise. The vulgar and debased termed her charitable. The insolent and unjust dubbed her amiable. The conscientious and benevolent generally at first accepted as valid her claim to be considered one of themselves. But ere long, the plating of pretension wore off. The real material appeared below, and they laid her aside as a deception. The end of chapter 15. Read by Rick Kistner for Lit2Go on the web at fcit.usf.edu.